All right, let's start the show then today. On a phone line is Jason Turner. Jason joins us again on WGN Radio. Hi, Jason. It's John. How are you?
Doing well, John. How about yourself?
Good. Jason's a chief investment strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. I want to ask you about a headline. We see this word a lot, rage. They say inflation is raging and the administration needs to do something about it, or the Fed does. I haven't shopped a lot, so maybe people really are noticing fantastic price jumps. But I wonder if it's being reported accurately. How would you characterize inflation right now?
Well, rage is a flashy word to say. You know, inflation's pretty high. This is the highest inflation we've seen on a headline consumer price inflation basis in 40 years, north of 7% inflation on the last print.
So does that mean that pretty much everything I bought has gone up 7%, or are only automobiles and energy driving that?
Well, you point that out accurately, that it's not necessarily everything that's increased in price by 7%. Some things like used cars are up nearly 40% over the course of the last couple of years. Other things like technology spending, for example, is actually down by about 12 basis points. Over that period. So that 7% increase is the aggregate price level. We're definitely seeing it in energy, definitely seeing it in food.
And you can't avoid the energy and you can't avoid the food. But I just wonder then, if the cost of living has gone up 7%, maybe it's more if you had to buy a car. But I just wonder if we're putting it in proper perspective. I think we're fanning the flames of inflation here. I mean, we're reporting it, but I'm just trying to keep it in some sort of perspective. Is my day-to-day cost gone up 7% to live in America right now?
Yeah, on average, the CPI or the PCE, which the Fed uses instead of CPI, are both weighted based on how consumers spend their dollars. So the broad comment that my cost of living is up by 7% is probably just about accurate.
Yeah.
Now, that's just over the course of the last year, though.
Fair enough. So then the president is backing the Fed chair, Jerome Powell's policy to tighten things up as inflation rages, huh?
I think the Fed has its dual mandate in place. It's trying to fight inflation and ensure, quote unquote, full employment. And we've reached that level of unemployment at 3.9% on the last update, to say that the employment market is there and it has its problems. But on the inflation side, that's the Fed's next battle, and they're ramping up to start fighting that here through the middle part of this year.
What's your analysis of the jobless claims, 286,000? What does that tell us?
I think it tells us a couple things. One, it tells us that the Omicron variant that didn't really impact the employment market much in December has had a bit of an impact on hiring and firing in the economy. It also tells us it's the end of the holiday season. And while we didn't see large amounts of jobless claims in the month of December, maybe some of that was back-end loaded. Retailers not getting rid of staff on a temporary basis like they normally do in a seasonal cadence, and maybe a little bit more of that in January as consumer spending slowed down.
Also, $100 oil, is that going to happen in my lifetime here? Like, and by that I mean the next couple of weeks?
With oil at $87 a barrel already today, the 90s are certainly well within the crosshairs. And I think a couple big banks have come out and said, you know, we're going to be north of 100 by the midpoint of this year. And that's certainly a psychological barrier for us to cross. And it's well within the probabilities that we'd see $100 oil by the midpoint of this year.
Does expensive oil sometimes mean that the economy is going to get better?
The price of oil, you know, it moves somewhat independently of the economy and somewhat linked to the economy. And as we see more demand for oil as the economy grows, we certainly will see more upward movement in price unless oil supply reacts. And we're about 15% short on a supply basis here in the United States in terms of U.S. oil production from where we were before the pandemic. And that's pretty much echoed globally.
I guess my thought was that in the past, when oil prices went up, it was because demand was higher, and demand was higher because more goods and services are being delivered, or there will be a demand for pent-up goods and services, so the price goes up. I don't know if that's the exact formula that's in play right now.
It's a big chunk of it, and demand is pulled back a little bit in December, but we certainly are seeing consumer demand broadly across the economy higher. Businesses, for example, even if consumers aren't buying as many things, they're still getting as many things shipped to them as they restock inventories in the light of the supply chain difficulties we've had over the last 18 months.
Somebody reminded me, I forget what the number was, something like 12,000 or something like that, jobs for truck drivers that are unfilled at any given point. That's got to be part of it too, right?
Certainly is. If you pay attention to job boards or even billboards along the side of the highway, there's a lot offering, you know, six-figure incomes for folks willing to cross over and start driving trucks.
Yeah, no kidding.
That just says, hey, wages are going up for those jobs that are in demand.
Jason Turner is the Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management, wintrustwealth.com. Hey, Jason, always good to talk to you. Thanks for helping us out today.
Thanks, John.
Joan Salzman joins us, senior reporter at CNET. We talk about technology usually with Joan and our friends at CNET. Welcome again, Joan. You're on WGN.
Thanks for having me again.
You know, I know that one of the big stories this week is about the Microsoft is striking that big deal with Activision Blizzard. I don't know if that impacts my world, though. If I don't play games, is that a big deal to me?
Well, certainly one of the reasons that Microsoft is going after this mega deal, $68.7 billion, one of the biggest deals Microsoft has ever attempted, one of the reasons that it's hoping that people like you, people that maybe it can bring into the casual gaming universe, not that hardcore World of Warcraft gaming universe, but, you know, casual gaming, maybe that audience is going to be expanding as we've seen video game audiences expand and reach older individuals, reach people that just use a mobile phone. And so by making such a big bet on video gaming, Microsoft really believes that video games will become a cornerstone of entertainment as we move forward.
Yeah. My producer just whispered in my ear, hey, John, maybe if Microsoft bought Wordle, because that's the game we're all playing, but Wordle wouldn't sell its soul that way. You know, my problem with video games in the gaming universe is that they can do so many things. I do not appreciate the violence that they depict, but they just look too complicated to me. When video games first came out, you moved a ping pong paddle up or down, and then maybe you drove a car or ate little blinking lights, and that was the extent of it, and anybody could do that. But now I've got to be able to do a kick shot, you know, fire a sword, and I'm like, it's too difficult to learn. So I'll tell you what, if they want to introduce, as you say, the casual gamer or potential gamer, come up with something stupid for people like me, you know.
Well, I think that's probably why we're seeing such an interest in Wordle. Its simplicity, its sort of purity as like a not-for-profit, I guess you could call that. It's definitely not a profit making scheme. But, you know, Activision Blizzard, though, it's mostly associated with things like Call of Duty, World of Warcraft, the stuff that has no attraction for you. It also is the maker of Candy Crush, which may not be, you know, at the level of popularity it was a few years ago, but certainly that's something that they've diversified into so that casual gamers that just want to connect candies together and make them disappear could get into too.
There's a bill before Congress that targets surveillance advertising. Tell us what surveillance advertising is and then what some lawmakers want to do about that.
Right. Well, surveillance advertising, the way that they're sort of describing it, it's one of the most prevalent ways that tech giants make money through advertising on the internet. Any surveillance advertising, they're kind of clumping it together with any sort of advertising that relies upon widespread data collection, your personal data collection, and trackers in order to make guesstimates. And in some cases with companies like Google, companies like Meta, aka Facebook, make highly sophisticated guesses about the kind of products and services you're most likely to be interested in.
Okay, but hasn't that ship sailed? What are they going to do about that? I thought we all agreed that that's the world we live in.
Well, there has been an upsurge in criticism and scrutiny over these kinds of targeting practices, these kinds of data tracking practices. So far, you're absolutely right. We haven't seen a lot of actual action, especially in Washington, that would disrupt these sort of key businesses for companies like Google and Meta. But if there are things that can pass, you've seen, for example, there in Europe, there was what's known as the GDPR legislation that passed in order to improve privacy for people that are using the internet. We haven't seen that on a scale here in the United States, but bills like this in tandem with other bills that are hoping to target Silicon Valley, we are seeing a lot more action at the early stages to possibly start taking on some of these practices.
Yeah, that's interesting. Although, is this still true that when I say something about red cars to my friend, or I read a story online about red cars, and then I see ads populate my feeds about red cars, that's not them listening. That's not them, quote unquote, targeting me, right? It's just coincidence. They send out a zillion red car ads and it lands randomly in the laps of people that happen to be talking about it. That's the way that phenomenon's been explained to me. Do you understand what I'm asking? And is that still true?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you have it right, but only half right. There is a phenomenon where people assume that their phone must be listening to them or their Alexa must be listening to them, because let's say they'll have a conversation about going skiing with their friends, and all of a sudden they're getting skiing ads. But what's interesting is that tech companies are so good at the data collection that they do that you don't voice, the things that you search, the websites you click on, the posts that you linger on in your news feed on Facebook or Instagram. They don't need to be listening to you that way. Their surveillance of your data, the little indications that you send out into the internet with everything that you do, they're so good at that. It feels like they must be listening in.
They have an algorithm that determines how long I've lingered over a story or an ad?
Oh, definitely. Facebook's tracking everything.
And is this legislation that we're talking about targeting that practice or not?
It's mostly targeting ads that are premised on this widespread collection of personal data. And so things like display ads that happen to be specifically placed with a particular article, for example, that would still be fair game. But it's these personalizations based on data that, you know, for example, the same article could be serving you a red car ad, could be serving me a skiing ad. Those are the things they want to take on.
Instagram is going to have some sort of subscription model. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, it's a very small test, just about 10 creators. But they've been invited to participate in the ability to have a subscription for your audience, right, in Instagram. Now, of course, Instagram influencers and creators, their biggest way of making money on Instagram is to reel in sponsorships, have those sponsored posts, kind of like product placement where they pitch a product or service. But by having a test like this, it could open up a new way for people to make money on Instagram directly instead of having to turn to a third-party service like Patreon to build up their own subscription model.
I guess it's a way for Instagram to make money too, huh?
Yeah, definitely. There's certainly going to be, like on Patreon, there's certainly going to be some sort of revenue share or commission that Instagram will take. And certainly Instagram's popularity and the fact that it's Instagram's sort of interest, the audience of Instagram is always, it's around products, it's around visuals, it's about things. You know, TikTok's about having fun with your friends, dances and memes. YouTube's about vlogs and videos, but Instagram really is about things and lifestyle. And so it's a really rich opportunity, not only for creators, but Instagram to get a cut of the way that it can get build subscriptions off of.
Will 5G mobile signals really disrupt airplanes?
That's the worry, and people are worried enough. Regulators, aviation officials are worried enough that there are a lot of canceled flights in the U.S. You know, we worry about this time of year with weather disrupting travel. This rollout of upgraded 5G cellular service, there's a lot of concern that it could mess with some airplanes' instruments. And so some major airlines, Emirates, Japan Airlines, and they have been canceling flights because they can't switch some of their flights to planes that have already been approved as being safe, even in the signal change.
I understand their concern. I want them to be, Lord, as safe as they want to be. But we don't have any evidence yet. It's more a worry. It's not like that airplane didn't work because somebody had a 5G phone working, right?
It's not about usage of having a 5G phone. It has to do with this band of radio wave spectrum. So it's known as the C-band, and I know it's technical kind of jargon, but what it was, it's this band of radio waves that were previously unavailable to things like mobile carriers in order to deliver, you know, crystal clear signals, rapid fire data, quick download times, quick downloading to your phone. And the C-band of spectrum, carriers have combined spent $70 billion to acquire just because it is so good at offering faster and wider reaching signals. But because it's that really good, like, low band frequency, there's also these worries that it could interfere around airports with the signaling and the instruments that planes use to know how far they're off the ground. So it is a small chance. It's when airplanes are landing at an airport and there's low visibility. Some planes have been cleared that there's not going to be any interference, but some planes haven't yet. And so it's with those planes that some airlines are canceling out of the abundance of caution. Certainly, we don't want the evidence that there is a problem by having a crash landing, nobody wants.
Yeah, fair enough. Joan Salzman, senior reporter, CNET.com. Nice to talk to you, Joan. Thanks for your help today.
Great to talk to you, too.
How about this one? What percentage of cardholders carry debt from month to month? What percentage of credit card holders carry a balance and therefore have to pay whatever that big old interest rate is? I would guess, let's put Ted Rossman on now. He joins us once again on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Bankrate.com, where he's a senior industry analyst. I'm reading your story, Ted, and if I'm reading this right, the number is 39%?
That's correct, yes. And it's a lot of people. You know, what's interesting is that this situation has actually improved over the past couple of years. So it's still bad. I mean, that's still an awful lot of people carrying very expensive debt. The average credit card rate is north of 16%, and it's probably headed higher this year. So even though we've made progress, we still have more work to do. I think paying down credit card debt would be a great financial goal for 2022.
Which Americans have been doing, and I'll talk to you about that in a second. But to be clear then, on any given month, the banks are only making money on 39 out of 100 people, at least with their credit cards, right?
They're only taking in interest payments from those people. But I would note that there are other revenue streams. Like, for example, merchants pay card companies something on the order of 2 or 2.5% every time somebody swipes their card. So that interchange revenue can be significant. There's also the annual fees that a lot of people pay, and then other fees, late fees, foreign transaction fees, things like that. So it is still a profitable business.
We are using credit cards less, though, or at least we were paying down the debt during the pandemic, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's actually been a really good thing for households. Back in Q1 of 2021, that was kind of the recent bottom. At that point, credit card debt had fallen 17% from the end of 2019, according to the New York Fed. So 2020 was a big year of debt pay down between stimulus payments, people spending less, really making this a priority. We did see balances start to tick up as 2021 went on. And the most recent data we have is from Q3. Balances are still down from the end of 19. They're still down about 13%. They have been ticking up, though. Looking at other holiday season data, I do think there's a good chance that they jumped in Q4, and now that we're dealing with all this inflation, you know, I do worry that before long, we might be right back where we started.
Do you think that the trend towards online shopping increases credit card debt?
Well, it makes it easy to make impulse buys. I mean, that is definitely part of it. Also, you can't really use cash online. I mean, I guess you could use a debit card, of course. But yeah, we know that there is definitely less pain associated with making a frictionless transaction like that. So that's actually a tip. You know, if you're trying to cut back, maybe you should actually use cash or debit, or maybe don't save your card number on websites. I mean, these are some kind of mental tricks you can play. Maybe institute a 24-hour waiting period before buying something. What I worry about now, though, in the context of debt going up, is that it's not just impulse buys, it's all the necessities. We've seen gas prices, grocery prices, rent, so many things influenced by inflation. And I think that's really going to be a theme this year. I think rising interest rates will be a theme because I mentioned credit card rates are already high. The average is over 16%. That's the average low end of the range. That's really what people with better credit are paying. On the high end, it averages more like 24%. So if the Fed raises rates 3 or 4 times this year, maybe the low end becomes 17%, The high end is 25. I mean, these are really high rates. If you're only making minimum payments, you're going to be in debt for more than 15 years. So we definitely want to come up with a better plan. I would start with a 0% balance transfer card. These are great offers that last as long as 21 months.
I want to read a sentence from your reporting. It says here, Bankrate measures the average credit card rate at 16.3. It's even higher, 17.13, among accounts assessed interest at 17.13%. Someone making minimum payments towards the average credit card balance, so you're paying 17% on the average balance of $5,500, would be in debt for more than 16 years and would owe more than $6,500 in interest. You would pay more in interest than you would on the balance if you made the minimum payments.
The math is really shocking, and I think that, you know, we talk so much about, oh, interest rates have been so low and record low mortgage rates, and that has really not extended to credit cards. Those rates remain very high. They're probably going up. Clearly, a rise would not be your friend, but I think the main message here is that rates are already high. So I would argue that it almost doesn't matter as much if they're 15% or 16 or 17. What matters is that they're all high and that we want to come up with this good plan. 0% balance transfer cards are great because you pause that interest clock for close to 2 years in the longest cases. You could also try to get a low-rate personal loan. Sometimes if you have good credit, maybe you can get 5 or 6% over 5 years or so. There's also nonprofit credit counselors like Money Management International that can help you negotiate lower rates. Maybe you get, let's say, a 7% rate over 5 years to pay back this high-cost debt. The main messages are try to lower your rate and definitely accelerate that payback. We don't want you to make minimum payments forever and ever. Right. That's just really painful.
Is there a zero card you like?
There are some good ones that last as long as 21 months. Those names include the Wells Fargo Reflect card, the Citi Simplicity, and the Citi Diamond Preferred.
You say that one of the things that people like when the cards offer perks to them is cash back. Is that the principal feature that people want in a credit card?
That is Americans' favorite credit card feature by a wide margin. And that's not just a pandemic phenomenon. Even before the pandemic, cashback was more popular than travel rewards. I could tell you that travel rewards are often worth a little bit more on a cents per point or mile basis, but they're harder to use. So I would say a lot of people really like that simplicity and the universal appeal of cashback. So maybe you get a 2% no annual fee cashback card like Citi Double Cash or the Wells Fargo Active Cash. That's really a great starting point for a lot of people. But I'll stress that this only works in your favor if you're paying in full and avoiding interest. If you are carrying a balance, and we've said a lot of people are, then forget about cash back. You want to prioritize the interest rate, because even if you're getting 1 or 2 or let's say 5% cash back, which some cards give on some categories, that's not nearly as much as the 15 or 20 or 25% you might be paying in interest. So knock out the debt first and then go for rewards.
You can read more about this at Bankrate.com. Ted Rossman is the senior industry analyst at Bankrate.com. Well done, Ted. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Water Tower Place has a new tenant, Hubbard Street Dance Chicago. Cranes reports Hubbard will take over 13,000 square feet on the fourth floor, formerly occupied by Adidas, with rehearsal and teaching space. The dance company's director says people passing that space will get a partial view of rehearsals and classes in progress. Hubbard merchandise will also be on sale. Hubbard is the second cultural tenant at the struggling Michigan Avenue Vertical Mall. The Chicago Sports Museum Memorabilia Hall has been at Water Tower since 2014. United Airlines says it lost $646 million in the fourth quarter as COVID-19 cases surged across the U.S. CEO Scott Kirby says the Omicron surge has impacted near-term demand, but the airline is optimistic about the spring and excited about the summer and beyond. Thousands of flights were canceled over the holidays as airline employees called out sick with COVID-19. I'm Steve Gratanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Time for the business of food. That's Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. The chairman of the board, Frank Sinatra, is going to help us out with today's report.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They've got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil.
And somebody who buys a lot of that coffee is Tony Dreyfus, the CEO and co-founder of Metropolis Coffee in Chicago.
We buy from Brazil. We buy a lot from Colombia, a tremendous amount from Central America.
Hundreds of tons of it a year that are brought to Chicago to be roasted.
Right around 750,000 pounds of coffee annually.
About 2 weeks ago, Tony gave us a quickie course in Coffee 101, where we learned, among other things, that
coffee beans are actually seeds.
But there was so much more we didn't have time to get to, including how is coffee decaffeinated? Tony knows.
Caffeine is bonded in the seed. The traditional way to kind of break that bond and get rid of the caffeine was to use a chemical solvent.
Which would break the bond and then the caffeine would be washed out.
Which can then be harvested and used for like soda and aspirin, all kinds of things.
But that chemical process fell out of favor in the 70s, and the Swiss water process came into vogue, which was
just really water and high pressure and osmosis to pull the caffeine out through the seed.
And now there's something new to separate the caffeine from the coffee seed.
We're actually starting to use it a bit at Metropolis. There's a solvent that's made from sugarcane. So it's an all-natural solvent.
But coffee lovers will tell you that decaf tastes different.
We found with both the chemical process and the water process, there's a kind of a telltale flavor that comes from each process. And with the sugarcane, it's just a little bit sweeter and a little bit nicer.
Tony Dreyfus of Metropolis Coffee Roasters. You can read a lot more about coffee, including recipes, and also the great work Metropolis does in the community at metropoliscoffee.com. From the farm to your belly, oh, this would pair well with a cup of coffee. It is National Butter Crunch Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
On the Wintrust Business Lunch, Amy Guth joins us to talk about Tom Cruise. Why not, right, Amy?
That's right.
So get started on that. I'm just reading this story. It sounds pretty... I didn't know we were this advanced that we would actually put a movie, studio in space?
That's exactly right. Just when we think we've kind of heard it all with the space race and all of that, this new detail. So there's a UK-based studio called Space Entertainment Enterprise, and they're contracting with Axiom to build this module, essentially like a module soundstage, a module studio that would attach to the International Space Station. So a spokesperson for the studio talked to CNBC about this production for this upcoming Tom Cruise movie. So essentially what's going to happen is the plan is in September of 2024, this first module of Axiom's will attach to the International Space Station. And then the C1, which is Space Entertainment Enterprises, is what they're kind of calling their module. Their next bit of it will launch in December of 2024 and attach to that. So essentially, that means Tom Cruise is going to theoretically make this movie in space. So never mind all the sound stages and the zero gravity kind of effects that we've seen in movies so far. He's going to actually be in space. I think I would be very unnerved if I were the producer of this, because that seems like a lot of risk to manage and a lot of variables. But that's the plan anyway.
Well, if you ask me, okay, guess which star is going to go into space to make a movie? He famously does his own stunts. He's famously fit. I guess Tom Cruise.
Yeah, I guess so, right? I mean, once you hear about it, you're like, well, okay, yeah, he is known for doing his own stunts. I guess that makes sense. You know, the idea of NASA being involved in the entertainment world is kind of a mind-boggling piece about it. But NASA did publicly comment in about 2020 that they were working with him on this film. So.
Oh.
You know, this has been of course, you couldn't do this on a whim. This has been in plans for a long time. But the spokesperson said this is currently in production. So I assume not all of it is in space, but whatever part will be filmed in 2024. I imagine that will be a really interesting box office draw when this film is eventually released. They didn't say the cost. They didn't say the name of the film. In fact, very little is known about it. But I imagine that'll be a very big box office draw when it is finally released, to be able to see, hey, here's the first film that's actually filmed in space.
Well, you measure the risk against the reward, and I think the knee-jerk reaction is, wait a minute, this is crazy, but the the natural evolution, I guess, of going into space is instead of just blasting millionaires up and back, let's find something to do up there other than communication satellites. And maybe something like this is a logical next step, right?
That's right. I mean, I'm no expert in space, but it does seem like, as Jeff Bezos, when he came back down to Earth, he said he was thinking of a lot of other business applications of space travel. And I suppose this would be an interesting next step for that.
Amazon is opening a clothing store. Tell me about this.
Right. A little bit counterintuitive sounding, right? So Amazon, of course, did so much to counter and really impact brick and mortar stores. But now they're opening a physical store in Los Angeles as a test. It'll be near a Nordstrom and a JCPenney, which are two brands that they really impacted quite a bit with the rise of e-commerce. So the way it will work, though, I thought was pretty interesting. So on the floor, there won't be like a rack of every size. There'll just be one sample of each item. And you use a QR code and you scan it, and then it goes to you go over to a pickup desk and you pick up the item. If you want to try it on, you can scan the QR code to have it sent to a dressing room where you can then try it on and use a panel in the dressing room to say, you know what, I want a different size. I'd like to change a little bit. And then you can check out from there using the Amazon app. You know, this is part of Amazon's strategy here, and CNN Business has done a lot of reporting on this. But they noted that about 85% of U.S. retail sales are still happening in store, and so Amazon feels like this is a way to capture some of that, because it's hard sometimes online to just say like, well, I don't know how this would fit. I don't know what the fabric feels like. Is it heavier fabric? Is it itchy? You know, you might want to kind of look at those kind of things before you just order the clothing. And especially as we've seen delays with shipping issues and supply chain, that's kind of kept people going to physical stores. But I think this is a really interesting experiment. You know, Amazon, of course, has Whole Foods, and that's their big retail footprint. But they did the Amazon Go, and we saw some decline in those leading into the pandemic, even before the pandemic, and then a bigger decline in 2020. A little bit of an uptick in 2021 as people started to venture out a little bit. But I think this will be a really interesting experiment to keep an eye on.
Amazon Go, the stores that you don't have to have employees or cash,
right.
You just shop and it knows what you're taking. Yeah, I wondered if the world was ready for that. About a minute left. Oscar Mayer is it Oscar Mayer that's making a bologna face mask?
This really kind of cracked me up. So, you know, remember when you were a kid, you'd like bite little holes in the bologna and hold it up so it looked like a mask? It's kind of an homage to that. So Oscar Mayer has this bologna-inspired face mask. It sold out in about a day after it was released on Amazon, speaking of Amazon. Kraft Heinz is part of this. What I found very funny is there's a note on the packaging, very large. It says, do not eat bologna masks. So it's definitely not edible. It is a hydrogel mask, but it sure looks like, if you Google a picture of it, it sure looks like putting a piece of bologna on your face.
It
but
does.
It's supposed to,
I've seen pictures of it and I thought, okay, that looks like bologna on your face. Why do you have that on your face? I know it's not bologna, but why do you want to look like you have bologna on your face?
I think that's the big question. But, you know, this is part of Kraft Heinz has that kind of cheeky advertising. They've done a couple things like this. You know, they've had some different flavors of mac and cheese ice cream, things like
right.
that.
Yeah.
You know, so I think they have kind of a playful approach to some of their marketing. But again, this face mask that is supposed to be hydrating and restoring and improve elasticity of the skin, it sold out in about a day.
John Williams, Amy Guth, NASA has been in the movie production business ever since they filmed our fake landing on the moon. Thank you for that, 260. And Amy, thanks for your reporting here.
Thanks so much, John.